perfectionism is the flip side of another topic, in my opinion, is a flip side of another topic that's been discussed in about every communal organization, every meeting, every conference, the problem of children going off the derech. I see many children both who go off the derech and children who have this problem of perfectionism, and it dawned on me at one point that basically we're talking about the flip side of the same coin. So basically when we're talking about perfectionism, we're talking about children who feel, or it happens by adults too, that anything less than perfect is shameful and unacceptable. And I think that, as I said, I think that very often not only are the same underlying emotional factors causing the same both problems, but very often perfectionism is a precursor to rebelliousness or other forms of acting out. Often when I speak to kids who rebel, they say that, you know, ninth grade or in 10th grade, they were the perfect student. They were managed there by davening at 5 o'clock in the morning. They went three times to the mikveh before davening, and they were davening at 3 hours shmonesra, and they were ever doing and learning day and night. And then somewhere down the road, it fell apart, and then it switched to rebelliousness. I think almost all mechanchim, I guess depending on the age group, are familiar with students who were taka perfect, and then something dramatically changed. And we were sort of mystified by the phenomena. Like, what has happened? Was the beautiful behavior we saw before just an illusion? Or was it real? And if it was real, like, what happened all of a sudden? I think the form of the change takes, there's a few ways this comes about. Some youngsters become depressed. You know, they seem to be doing very well, they were doing in fact excellent, and they were at the top of the class, they were getting wonderful marks, they were behaving beautifully, and all of a sudden they become very depressed. Sometimes it comes to a point of a nervous breakdown. That comes from, I believe, the chronic frustration and pressure of falling short of perfection. Because inevitably if somebody tries to be perfect, as I said last night, since only the Bnei Shem is perfect, so obviously we're going to chronically because it comes short. And therefore, we constantly be frustrated. The other day, a young lady was telling me that she's feeling terribly guilty. Why? She has a terrible problem with anger. She talks to her mother in an angry way. It's not to be that vain. She asked her to describe to me, like, what happened. She described the conversation that I had no clue what she was talking about, because it sounded like a pretty open, you know, she was having an honest conversation with her mother. It didn't sound like anything terrible. I thought first I missed the point. I said, well, have you told me everything that you've said? She says, yeah. I said, what's the problem? She says, well, she should be like her brother, because her brother never ever gets angry. Like, he's like the perfect, she wants to be like that. The fact that she felt angry is ready to develop a time on her. She doesn't know, the mother had told me originally when she heard her that her brother's in therapy too. She doesn't know that. He has plenty of his own problems that he can't get angry. That's one of his problems. But she's looking at this as the ideal, that the ideal person would never feel angry. So the fact that she feels angry, though she had dealt it in a fine way, she somehow felt it was a terrible thing. I had a young man, mom was terribly sad to see this happening to a youngster. He's about 13 years old. And he tells me, you know, I've seen him only about 5-6 times, they're relatively new patients. He tells me that he has a problem, big problem. What's the problem? He gets up late. Oh yeah, how long do you have this problem? He tells me since Sukkot, which was 2 weeks before the time I was talking to him. I thought he was talking about Zalta Maisa, you know, that already for years, you know, he can't get up. I said, yeah, really, whatever. So you sleep like very late in the morning, you don't get to come late to yeshiva. He says, no. I usually go to minyan at 7 o'clock, and you know, since Sukkot I've been getting up as I'm getting to 7:15 minyan instead of the 7 o'clock minyan. So what's the problem? So you come to yeshiva late? No, he gets yeshiva in time, but he comes like rushing into Seder, so when he's sitting down, he doesn't have the full yeshiva das, because, you know, he's a little bit tzitzum because it came late. Then he tells me, you know, I tried an eitzah, like he tried various eitzahs. So what was his eitzahs? He put up a note for himself. Loser, get out of bed. Yeah. Alright, so some kids become depressed, and other children develop chronic somatic symptoms, right? You have kids who develop chronic headaches, having stomach aches, nausea, Epstein-Barr syndrome, and various other things. There's a doctor in New York, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, he's written a few books, he's been in the media, in the recent issue of U.S. News World Report had a thing on him, Dr. John Sarno, who's a orthopedic surgeon who just from his, purely from his experience, he has absolutely no psychological background, never was trained in it. By now he's more of an expert in psychology than many psychologists. And he came to the conclusion that these people with chronic back pains and headaches and everything else are simply suffering from stress, from repressed feelings, and so on. He sends me many patients. He gets many, many from patients, and he sends me a lot of referrals. So I get to see a lot of them. And it's Mamzela Yulman to you, super. There's boys that come in. There's a boy that came. She was buffer that was 4 months at home. Chronically nauseous. He's been MRI from bottom to top with every medical test known to mankind. Totally stressed. And he went through a tkufa, he became very frum, came from a more modern background that he went turned out there was tremendous problems at home, there was Shalom Bais, it was atrocious, and he was mixed in the middle. He went there to Israel to try to escape from it all by becoming very frum. He came back, he went to yeshiva that was totally not like his background, and he lasted about a year and a half. He was like mamish from the best bachrim there, and that's it. Then one day, that was it. He was chronically had somatic symptoms on a daily basis, and he stopped functioning. And it was only after quite a few months, about 9 months of therapy, until he finally got back on his feet. So that's another form of how the perfection and how the symptoms develop. Another way, as I mentioned before, is that sometimes the perfectionism leads to acting out, rebelliousness. Again, you get the same, like a young lady that was sent for therapy, she's breaking the rules in the school, she wasn't dressing sneezing, doing other things that she wasn't supposed to be doing, and again, it's the same MO. Last year, she was one of the best students in the class, she was the most frum girl in the class, and suddenly they had this change. Another form of this problem, it's a bit complex, but more rare, thankfully, but I'm seeing it more and more. You have what we call a vertical split. In other words, you have, because the person has a tremendous need to feel perfect, because the source of the perfectionism is low self-esteem. If somebody feels very critical of themselves, feels very low about themselves, so the way to compensate for that is to feel perfect. However, it's very difficult for a person to feel perfect because people have impulses, they have yetzaharas, and they have other things, so it's what do you do? You pretend like that's not you. That's a different person. The chasar, so there's a maila and a chasar. The maila is that the person that you like better is almost paka perfect, because anything that's not perfect doesn't belong to you. The chasar is that eventually those other feelings assert themselves, and they're not moderated by the other mailas in the person. One day it struck me as similar to the idea of like bittul, the difference between lach b'lach and yavish b'yavish, right? But lach b'lach has a chesaron because every part that's kosher has a bissel trait in it too, right? But it's all watered down. Yavish b'yavish has a maila. If you have one shtickle, it could be totally kosher. But the problem is you have a piece that's totally trait. There's no moderation. And that's how there's some people that when a person is desperately needs to be a perfectionist, he splits off everything that has no shayachis, and what you actually see as a symptom is that you'll have a person who holds himself to be a grace of Ben Aliyah, and he can quote you Yedda Musa Sefer Mamsh Bal Peh, right? And on the other hand, he's doing things that most people with the biggest yetzaharas don't do. So, how do the two things mix together? That's how the taka don't mix together. That's not the problem. It's like two separate people. It's not like a regular person who represses, because then when it comes up, it's still the same person. There's one fellow, he walked in, he came in with all of Rabbi Yisrael's farm, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, he asked me that he wants me actually to sit and learn with him, Rabbi Yisrael. That was going to be his Eitzah. I said, I think you've tried that for many years. He said, how do you know? I said, well, quite obvious. I said, I think that's work. Let's try a different approach. There's a word from my grandfather, Rabbi Yemir Bloch. He says that, he brings on a medrash, that Ben Tzadik Shechotah, you're allowed to call him a Rasha Ben Rasha. It's like a shot. He's a Ben Tzadik. He says, obviously, every person, no person is 100% a Tzadik. Everybody has a Tzad Rishis. So this child must have taken after the Tzad Rishis. He says, the kids are the Kavard. So I was trying to understand, what does that mean? So it's because a person is not 100% a tzaddik, so he's allowed to call him a Russia bin Russia. as a yaiser. I think it's maybe you can explain it with this nekuda. We're not talking about a person who has a shtickle rishu. What do you say about a person who's not 100% a tzaddik? You have a person who's taka an emes tzaddik. What's felt in the sitkis? That sometimes he davens not with 100% kavana. It's only 90% kavana. He's not 100% a tzaddik. We're not talking about it. We're talking a person where it's not integrated, where those two aspects of the personality are not integrated. So that's taka rasha ben rasha, because that has no shaykhis to the tzaddik part. It's a little difficult to explain. You have to see it but that also comes from the same insight. Now, the actual diagnostic categories that one sees with perfectionism is usually two. Besides depression that we mentioned before, you either have obsessive compulsive disorder, that I'm sure all of you have had unfortunate occurrence to notice among your students who either have compulsive behaviors like washing hands millions of times. But I think what's more common, you have kids who daven, 3 hours Shmoneh Esrei, and nothing they do is ever good enough, and they're constantly worried about that maybe something they did wasn't good. In other words, those are people who are trying to do everything perfectly. Or you have narcissism, people have feelings of grandiosity where they're trying to be perfect. They both come from the same yisite, even though they're different behaviors. In other words, if a person feels that he's a terrible person, so two things happen. Either you have to behave so perfectly so you won't have an excuse to have tainus on you, because I mentioned to Rabbi Reimann, who wrote a book of history, I said there's something he writes there about the Eivda Avodah Zarah, that the Eivda Avodah Zarah, not only did they believe there's more than one God, but besides that, the type of God that they had was somebody who was capricious, who only wanted to hurt you, and the whole Avodah was to appease that. And Avraham Avinu not only was Mechadish, there's only one God, but it's Fakir, there's a Taiv, and Rachum, and the Fakir wants to do good to you, Taiv writes a Hektiv. So I told Rabbi Reimann before we shared a Mechutin, I wrote him a letter once, I said, you might not believe this, but the many Shiva Bachim still believe, who are you by the Zarin, the Gabidus Nakuda. Right? But they could see their Vaisham the same way, as somebody who's looking for an excuse to punish them, and any excuse, it's like the schoolyard bully lawyer like me. So many of the states of the only eight is because if you do everything perfectly well, then you're safe. The flip down another app from the same Shirish, when you have somebody who feels very low about themselves, you can automatically assume that anybody that has very low self-esteem, you can be certain that there's a counterbalance. The lower this goes, the higher this goes. That somewhere deep down there's feelings of grandiosity. I remember there was once a youngster I saw that probably had the lowest self-esteem I've ever ran into. And finally, after months and months, he finally says, I'm going to tell you something, the biggest secret, the mamish, whatever. What's the secret? Because sometimes I feel I'm greater than the Rabbi Yishalom. I thought you thought I was going to fall off my seat. No, I was waiting for him to tell me. Because obviously, you have such low self-esteem, you have to counterbalance it with something. So again, there's something related to the split, that you have like these two things within the same person that it changes. Sometimes you feel very low, and so you'll see sometimes you talk to people who have a low self-esteem, sometimes you get a glimpses of that grandiosity. They don't want to listen to anybody, they know better than anybody else. And the eights, you tell them they don't want to listen to. One of the big difficulties with this problem, the unlike acting out or rebelliousness, where the problem is obvious, and we're very alert to it, and everybody tries, but Hashem, there's many, a lot of the constant will try to help and find an answer. This problem is a little bit hidden, because on the surface it looks like the most wonderful thing in the world. You have somebody who's so well behaved and wants it as the chanchim. That's what you do all the time. You try to inspire people to grow in ruchnius and to take the ruchnius seriously. It's not complaining now. So Baruch Hashem, you have somebody who's doing it. You're going to complain about it. Right? So that's the difficulty. Is that very often I see these youngsters, they've been suffering this for years and nobody's picked it up. Because what are you supposed to say? The guy's well behaved and he does everything he's supposed to and he does it, he runs to the base medrash every 3 minutes he has. What are you going to complain about it? I'm sorry? Halavai, but the whole base medrash should be like that. So that's a shtickle, that's a reason what's the problem. What's talk of the problem? What's the problem with it? So very good. If somebody wants to be perfect, I mentioned this last night that sometimes we have the feeling that even if we see it's not so healthy, but we figure, so what do you lose? If somebody tries to be perfect, you won't be perfect, so it'll be 80%. So it's actually good. Okay, the more perfect you try to be, the better. But obviously that doesn't work that way because as opposed to people who have a healthy source of wanting to do well, where even if they do less than perfect, they still feel good about themselves and they still recognize the accomplishment. Here, the people, a person who's a perfectionist feels it as a tremendous source of humiliation and shame and feels totally devastated. And I, when I mentioned last night about girls who start crying when they have a 95, it sounded from the reaction that, that is, we're not talking about something that's very foreign to many of the girls. I think that the, a person who has a healthy desire to do well understands that there's an inyan of a process involved. And can get a sense of enjoyment even if, and the satisfaction even from the process of growth. Not necessarily always having to reach the end goal of perfection. One way to evaluate if a youngster's aspirations and excitement and the desire to do well, whether it's healthy or not, one thing is you observe how they react to a less than perfect performance. That's one of the clues. If you see the person is mildly disappointed but yet happy that they did fairly well, so that's a good sign. If they're totally devastated as if the end of the world just came, so that's a bad sign. That shows that the source is not a healthy source. Also, you have to look at the total gestalt. In other words, usually there are other signs. A perfectionist is other things going wrong. When one youngster told me, you know, that how his Rebbeim liked him because he was always in the Beis Medrash. He says, it's a double question. I was so scared of socializing with people, so of course I went to the Beis Medrash. You know, when all the kids went to the playgrounds, I went to the Beis Medrash because I had this way, if I have to face this thing that I didn't know how to do, is to socialize. So if you look at the total picture, if you look what's a kid's social life like, what's his home life like, and usually if there are problems in these other areas, does he know how to communicate, does he or she know how to communicate, and if they have problems in those other areas, it's a pretty likely sign that the source is not healthy. As I mentioned last night also, that you know, a lot of times when another sign of perfectionism is that the strivings are uneven. It's not across the board. Somebody who has a healthy sense of growth and a desire to accomplish, usually you see it goes across the board, more even. Although, you know, with teenagers, usually not too even anyway, but it's, you know, it's relatively even. A certain amount of unevenness is you know, normal at that age. But you know, with perfectionists, you see it's dramatically uneven. There's some things that they manage to feel like you can't believe, and other things they're totally negligent about. That's usually a sign that they're usually putting a lot of effort into those areas where they can impress other people, not really coming from a sense of growth. What is the source of this problem? I think the source of the problem, I think why it's more prevalent today, is because I think most of the... I said it more of a remiza last night. I didn't think it was appropriate to say it so much to Barabin, you know. But I think the source is that the kids, I think, today are criticized much more than they ever were before. For two reasons. First of all, the standards are higher. We expect more. Second of all, another reason, as I shared it with a few people here, there's the Keser Reish. You know, from the Chaim Volozhin in the back of the Seder Agra, he brings down the Medrash, Yizaru b'bnei aniyim shemahim takes a Torah. Right, so usually the Ilum shot because the bnei aniyim have less gashmias. But he says a very interesting original shot. He says because the bnei ashirim, the wealthy people, have already spent a lot of money for melamdim uflogdim. Right, they hired the best tutors and they've already been harassing their kids, you know, to learn all the time already. So by the time they're 13, they're washed out already. They're burnt out. Mashaykin the Bnei Anim, he says, are busy with trying to make a parnasa, then don't have time to bother their children. And by them, they still blive the kayach. By them, it's still the kayach. So by the time they come to yeshiva, you can bring them a kayach alapayo. They're not washed out. Very interesting. So I think that today, first of all, the standards have risen. I guess we have more time to harass our children. I don't know what it is, but you see sometimes when a father, you go to a Beis Medrash, you see sometimes a father's learning with a kid. I see a father learning with an 8-year-old kid. I can't, you know, if this kid still wants to learn when he's 13, I'd be totally amazed. I once saw, it was a frightening sight. I was sitting in a Beis Medrash between Milcha Meir. I saw a father learning with a kid between 8 or 9 years old. He was going over the Gemara. He asked the kid, do you know the Gemara? He says, yeah. And I heard the kid learning the Gemara. And, you know, he obviously knew it pretty well, not perfectly. And the father starts, you know, hey, why do you say this? Why? And the kid's like, he's an able kid. And he's getting all nervous. And the more nervous he's getting, the more confused he's getting. And the father starts screaming, it's in the middle of Beis Medrash. How do you say you know it? You're a shakrim, you don't know it, you know, and the kid was totally demolished. It happens more often than we would like to believe. I remember there was a fellow I was treating, who was about 21 or 22. One of his chronic problems was that he couldn't get up early in the morning. So, Meister Shahaya, the father was a mechanic guy. So, Meister Shahaya, He said that he got up one time. It was around Hanukkah time. He got up early. He figured if he goes back to sleep, he's never going to stay up. And he really wanted to work on it, so he went to Davin. So he went to 6 o'clock Minyan. He comes home, he's all proud of himself, and tells his father, "Oh, came back from Minyan." What time did you daven? 6 o'clock. 6 o'clock? That's too early. So yeah, but I was afraid to go back to sleep. That's not a teretz. He said, "Yeah, but there was a minyan. What do you mean? I mean, there was many people davening. Those are balabatim. You know, they can daven then. What? Yeah, but on some apollo, you know, that he got up at 6 o'clock. Again, I'm not telling you dramatic stories. These are things that happen very frequently. I think the basic, you say, I think it's probably the basic feeling that most of the kids are either depressed or acting out or are perfectionist. The basic feeling is they feel that they are a disappointment to their parents. That is the basic feeling. And I think when a kid has that feeling, you basically don't stand a chance. Because something is going to go wrong. It's either going to be externally or it's going to be internally. I've had parents who told me that's true. You know, when I asked them about it, they said, "Listen, if I'm honest with myself, sometimes one lady told me, she said, yeah, look, he was a very bright kid. I mean, he was a decent student. He always got decent grades. He learned decently, but I never thought it was enough. I thought he could do better." She said, yeah, it's not the truth that I always gave him the feeling that I'm not happy with him. Because what one lady recently told me about, she had many different, there were many stressors in her life, but the one thing she told me, I thought she put it in words because I've often thought of it that way, but she said, "I love him, but I don't like him." Another issue that's very, you often find by perfectionists is that the parents stress external things. Chitzonius. What does that mean? In other words, somebody I heard, my wife was mentioning that one of the things that people were talking about shidduchim, you know, that some of the boys are looking for girls, you know, so they're very emphasis on the chitzonius. I told my wife, and I said to other people, that I think the reason why that happens is because unfortunately some of these boys, and I've seen these boys, because they come to me and they're having a hard time getting married, and I ask what's the problem. It usually takes a little while, and then they, very embarrassingly, because they see themselves as being very from yeshiva bachrim. And I say, "What's the problem? You got with a girl, what's..." You know, it's a problem, you know, you're trying to figure out, how does he say this, you know? Oh yeah, okay, I understand. The question embarrassed because it, they themselves don't understand it. Like, how could a guy like me, that I mamash, I sit and I learn, and mamash, I'm Muslim, the ganze tog, how did this happen? They don't understand. It's just because their learning is also chitzonius, unfortunately. Their learning is to impress other people, right? There's no penis in it too. Many times when kids misbehave, their parents tell them, "You do this, what are people going to say? How are you going to get a shidduch?" Right? It's not because God said you shouldn't do this. So I think that a lot of times this, I think I saw something incredible just the other day from Rav Schwab in the Sefer. He says that you know, why does the Chazal tell us a lot of times about the others, that they were strong? Yaakov was able to pick up the Kiaver, that the Moshe Rabbeinu was able to pick up the Levium, that the Imos were so beautiful. Like, well, I don't tell you all these things. Like, what's the importance of it? He says an incredible word. He says, obviously, in the times of Chazal, in times of the others, there was no difference between Chitzonius and Pnimius. Whatever you saw in the Chitzonius, that was a Pnimius. He says, and that changed. That was a quota that happened, that there became a split. He says, that's why also why a Kayin, who's a Balmum, is possible for Avaida. Because at one time, that was a simon, there was something wrong with the Pnimius. Today, he says, there's already no Surai, the Pnimius of Chitzonius and Moshai. Okay, now, how do we overcome this problem? I think we need to... I find that sometimes I have a patient who's a perfectionist. Sometimes they're very bright because they can get away with this stuff because they can at least believe for a while that they could be perfect. Right? And they tell me over stories like, you know, "Oh, I had a Rebbe in ninth grade who told me I'm going to be the next Chazon Ish." Right? And then another guy tells me, "My Rebbe told me that mamish I have the midas from the rest of Tzadikim." And I said, "Mamish, encourage it." We have to give the kids a geschmack in the everyday things that they have to do. The fact of life is that most of the things we do are everyday things. Most of the things we do are not grandiose, are not grand. Right? The guy sits in Seder, you know, it's not every day he's going to find for a Rambam. Usually you just have to go through the Sugya and you have to learn through the Gemara and Rashi. That's what you do most of the time. Right? So it's very important that we give them, show them the Geschmack, to emphasize the importance of doing the everyday things in life. The Chashivas of doing the everyday things. I quoted last night, I won't go through the whole thing again, but from Rav Huttner, from the Pachet Yitzchak, that he talks about that a necessary ingredient, a prerequisite for having milus is a person that has to have a simcha from just being a pashat yidon madregas. It's a necessary prerequisite that you have to constantly stress. The main thing is that the children have to learn to impress themselves rather than impress other people. And that takes us into the whole subject of competition, which I'm going to cover in 2 minutes. There was some beautiful article that had recently in the Jewish Observer, an article about Weinberg's et al. And he has a shtickle over there on competition in the classroom. He says it beautifully, right? He says, I just read a few parts of it. He said, unfortunately, even the Chadarim have adopted competition as a means of motivation, complete with student comparison charts on the wall and beats to determine who knows the material the best. And therein lies the problem. The focus has shifted from who knows things well to who knows things best. No longer is accomplishment valued relative to one's own abilities and previous accomplishments, or even relative to an absolute standard of possibilities, but relative to what other individuals accomplish. Greatness is not understood as being the best I can, but being better than others. I have to tell you, this is a gefährliche problem. There's in the, he speaks about it, Revolta speaks about it, it's in Rav Eisman's wonderful book on parents and penguins or something like that. There's a footnote or table for competitions, developing the book. But it's a double push. I mean, you can stand on the Seichel HaYosher. The whole idea is to compete with somebody else and to be better than somebody else. So for Shteitzich, so obviously everyday accomplishments, what could they mean? I mean, millions of people do everyday things. So what's the great knack about doing everyday accomplishments? There's absolutely nothing to it. So what kind of a sense of accomplishment can a person have? I say for kids, you know, if a kid has a problem in a particular... take a simple example. Let's say you have a kid who's very bright, he's always on the honor roll. So what's the natural thing of each parent? He's proud. My kid, every week, and every mother's on the honor roll. And he tells his kid, it's wonderful, it's beautiful. He doesn't need compliments in that because then he knows how to do well. Now this kid may have some social problems. He may not be so adept socially. Either we don't notice it if we're so impressed by his brains. And in general, unfortunately, we put much more emphasis on the brains than we do on the emotions. Or even if we do notice it, but you know, it doesn't seem like such a big problem because he's the best student in the class. This kid needs a lot more encouragement and reinforcement for whatever little steps he takes in his social life. To such a kid, a compliment that he picked up the phone and called a friend and asked him to come play is a lot more meaningful than giving a compliment that he got another A. So those are really, I think, the 2 points, that if the focus is on the person and himself and his own growth rather than his comparison to others, I think more likely that the person will feel a sense of joy and gratification from the everyday things rather than the grandiose things. Before I open up to questions, what I've spoken about now is an article I wrote in the journal Psychotherapy. I bought some copies. If anybody's interested afterwards, I'll be happy to give it to you. Questions? Yes.
Did I understand from your presentation that his parents were totally responsible for this problem, that we as mechanics have absolutely no problem causing him?
Well, I spoke about competition. That has a lot to do with mechanchim, so I don't know if I want to say that way. I think definitely parents set the stage for it, because by the time you get the student, he's been through, you know, spent a lot of time with his parents. And I think, you know, what a parent thinks about a child is a lot more meaningful to the child than what his teacher thinks about it. Okay? You know, if a kid feels that his parents don't like him or are disappointed in him, it's going to be a lot more painful to him than the fact that his teacher is disappointed in him. Now, of course, it's wonderful both are happy with him. You know, I'm not minimizing the role of the teacher, but I don't think the pain that the child will feel is in the diamond. Well, first of all, for one reason, the parent remains the same parent all the time, and the teacher changes. But I think it's even more than that, because obviously the relationship with the parent, that's the might of a parent. The parent has just tremendous power, but that's also the responsibility increases. Yes.
The student is on a spectrum, and very smart, always making dollars per day. And when they eventually get into college or seminary, where they can no longer pull the grade A, can they handle it or they just crash?
Well, it depends how you prepare them. In other words, that phenomenon that you're talking about, you talk to people who are in elite colleges, let's say you talk to people in Harvard, right? What happens is they get let's say kids, some kid who came from somewhere in Iowa, you know, he was the best kid he was a top star student in his high school, and now he comes to a place where everybody's a star. He's no longer the star of the stars, you know, he's somewhere in the middle of the class. It can be extremely devastating. But again, depends on his emotional makeup and his preparation. Those people are at risk. Because a lot of them, without us even realizing it, because they're so great, and this is their feeling of happiness comes from I'm better than everybody else. And then, of course, eventually they run into somebody who's better than them, they could be extremely devastated. But those problems are saying, the problem with being very bright is that your emotions can be shot and nobody will notice it for 5 years. So you take the average kid who's not so bright, maybe that's why Shmuel Hanavi's mother was mispalo for, you know, a mamutza. Because there's a big problem with being very bright for this particular nekuda. You know, a kid who's average, if they have an emotional problem, it usually becomes obvious very quickly. You know, the grades become affected right away. A kid who's very, very bright can have the most incredible problems and nobody will have a clue about it for 5 years because he'll pull off and he'll still be, you know, he'll pull off great grades even using half his brain. Yes?
You mentioned that they'll have an arrow initial
okay, I don't want to, since I'm not an educator, I don't want to give an, but I would tell you what I would do, or what I do, and I guess depending on your setup or what, you know, what the mahalach is in your school, you can either do it or not. But I would say when there's a problem with a child, especially if it's a change, you know, a child who always was doing well and all of a sudden is not. So usually what happens is, because I hear when teachers describe to me what they've done until the point that I see them is, you know, sit down to explain to the kid, you know, why it's important to get up on time, or why it's important to dress in a certain way, why this is important, that's important. Nobody ever asked them, like, you know, what's wrong? So there's an assumption that something went wrong. I would also get into what's going on at home, because that's very often, I think, the cause. But, and again, I'm not saying that to be in every educational setting that's a wise thing to do or the right thing to do, but I'm saying as far as if you really want to know what's going on, that's a question to ask. Could be you can't ask it. But, there was a bacher once who came to me, he must have been about already 21, extremely depressed. So the kid tells me that I realize now in retrospect that I must be depressed for years, because every Rebbe I've ever had told me to smile. So I left him, you tell me, did any of your Rebbeim ever ask you why you weren't smiling? No. They just told me to smile. I mean, that's incredible. Why didn't they ever ask him why he's not smiling? He says, every Rebbe he's ever had from a sneaky thing he told me from sixth grade is always telling you gotta smile. Why didn't anybody ask him why he's not smiling? Yes. I'm sorry. No, because I think you're making it more difficult by asking you the question in such a setting. The question is to ask the child how they feel. They're not asking on the parents, you know, what's good or bad about their parents or bad. They're asking about the child. If the child's not getting along with his parents or feels that his parents think terribly about him, it has nothing to do with that. He's not asking anything about his parents. So you can avoid some of those problems. You're talking about the child's feelings. So you're not asking to pass him, you know, about his parents as a good people or bad people. Yeah. If there's any genetic predisposition, it's, you know, obviously those type of questions are hard to answer because it's hard to prove one way or the other. Now, there's certainly no, as far as I know, there's no solid evidence that there is. Even if there is, you know, there is evidence that kids are born with different temperaments. And again, this week's parsha, Rav Hirsch, Shem Shofal Hirsch says, it's a bit incredible, I mean, couldn't even say this, you know, if he didn't say it, but he says the reason why Esav turned out the way he is, not because he was born in Russia, the Odessa also says he wasn't born in Russia, but the Odessa says he was born with certain dispositions that made it maybe more difficult to deal with him, and, you know, maybe he was the first hyperactive child, I don't know. But what Hirsch says is that Yitzchak wasn't mechanech al pi darka. He tried to raise him like Yaakov, and he needed. Is there a medrash? Really? Okay. I don't know if Charetz said that it's true or Charetz they wrote it. Okay. I never seen that. All right. Yeah.
And I remember, and we all hear, and we talk about the time of the morning. aware of the psychological impact of what he's doing with the therapy. I think there are ways that maybe it's what he's doing. I think it makes sense because the stigmatizing of the police status is generally a particular study that's going to be there.
About what? I'm sorry.
Study.
Yeah, about what?
About the pressure that teens feel to make their work. And what we come up with as teenagers, and this is what we expect of the time, is that teenagers are more, much more interested in care. And the
years,
as opposed to. The parents don't have to bomb the program, really. The parents don't have to bomb the program. So, in essence, I think that there's a way to make a teacher's time to try out in a better grade, not to seem like the best teacher's time to spend. That's one of the ways to increase. And I know that feeling, you know, as soon as people say, how on our way to try to try to teach them things within the classroom, because they spend more time in the classroom than they do at home today.
Yeah.
They spend more time with the family, with the teachers, and I think that maybe a way that we can try to compensate them.
I will tell you that I know the studies that show that teenagers are very conscious about their peers much more than their parents. But that's on the conscious level. On the subconscious level, I still think it's the same thing. In other words, they're not so conscious about it because they may have either thrown it to the side or developed an attitude of not caring what their parents think. That's not true. It's skin deep. When you get a kid in therapy, you get them to open up a little bit. Even adults. You have 40-year-olds who are walking around. I saw 2 80-year-old ladies. Were sisters in a nursing home, right? And what was the biggest source of contention between these two ladies? Who did mommy like best? They were not even married 30 years, But this is what bothered them. This was the source of all their friction between the two. Oh yeah, let me get the second part. Now, of course, you can make it better or worse. The fact is that we do, right? And the problem with having an out of class and a base class, it's an old problem. No easy solutions, obviously. I think I mentioned, I mentioned somebody, there's a tape from Chaim Siegel, like a father from Chaim Berlin, from the Masifta, that he spoke to a group of Mechanchim, and he spoke about the fact that he had an experience when he was a Rebbe in the Masifta, in Crown Heights, I think before he joined Chaim Berlin, and there was an out of class and a base class, and the Rishiva was coming to Z, and the kids from the base class begged him, please don't bring the Rishiva here because they're stupid, we're the stupid class, And he said he was Makaba himself from that day on, and never again he's going to have an out of class and a class in the base class. I think somebody else, someone from the Chach, similar. So, of course that's a problem. They see that, again, because that's a problem with competition, because when competition is obvious, the teacher is making a statement, whoever's best in the class is best. So we're not judging them, each one for themselves, but in comparison to each other. So obviously we reinforce that. Yes?
If Marx and Gray understand why perception is very bad.
Right.
But you're all dealing with behavior, we always want children to behave well. How do we keep children in the middle line of behavior when we promote good behavior?
Right, so because the idea is when you're promoting good behavior, it has to be within a context. Because you're not only looking at the behavior has a meaning. Right? You can have a guy, the ace of essay, I give him ice from assault. You can do a lot of things that look impressive. The question is what the meaning of it is. Everything is a context. I remember there was a parents who came to me once, had a kid who was totally not sociable. A girl, she had no friends. Of course, they were very concerned, as they should be. And then I asked her, I kept asking, did she never had friends? So first they claim, no, she never had friends. Finally, after I asked, they remind themselves, just 2 years ago she developed a friend. I'm like, what? The family wasn't exactly, the type of family that they would want to prefer. Nothing major, we weren't drug addicts or anything. There was a case or whatever, I don't know, some of the movies, minor thing. I mean, it could be major if everything was going all right, but there's some... definitely in the category of minor. There weren't exactly as full in the place. I don't know, maybe they didn't eat Josh, and I don't know exactly what the problem was. It was something that was a problem. Again, I'm not minimizing those things as I'm talking about in the context of what we're talking about. Right? And that's it. They put an end to the friendship. That was the first and last friend this girl ever had. So, of course, we promote to have the right friends. That's, of course, a wonderful thing to promote, but you have to know what context. Revolver writes in the Akdamas, I was sure the first Chalik, he writes, if you learn Musar without knowing yourself, then you get in big trouble. He says, he gives an example. If my memory serves me right, so near as I look at that particular chalet, but he says like this. Imagine he says a guy, Tainus Dibur. We all know Tainus Dibur is like a wonderful thing, all the Bali Musa write about Tainus Dibur. Imagine if a person is socially withdrawn, right? I mean, think Tainus Dibur is poison, so you have to know who you're dealing with. So I think seeing things in context, and the children have to feel that. So when we see a kid's learning all day and he's avoiding friends, that's not a very healthy thing. If we see a kid's learning all day but he's depressed, Is that what he's supposed to be doing? If the kid's behaving, he's wonderfully behaved, but he's totally unassertive. He can't say no. I don't know, is that what we want? Is that what we teach them? Just because superficially it looks like he's so well behaved? I think we have to keep our eyes open and look at the context within which things are happening.
A lot of people have problems that determine if the adult is not being supported and hurt to the children. The particular role of protection must involve with it certain patterns of thinking, certain patterns of living, such emotions that would distinguish.
On the part of the parents.
Kid
child, yeah.
We often want children who are raised in the home to turn to our critical, and they don't become perfectionistic. I feel like if you look and see that kind of unique patterns that lead to the perfectionism, you know the reason for that the child, or not necessarily, you know, the chicken or the egg, is another question. What is it that perfectionism is part of?
I'm not sure if I have. I thought you were talking about on the part of the parent, because that's an interesting question too. You know, because I think somebody made a study. It's good. I was so excited when I saw the study, because I intuitively felt this for years, but you know, didn't make the study. And somebody made the study and showed, somebody compared mothers of aggressive boys and took a comparison to mothers of non-aggressive boys, showing them vignettes of certain normal behavior. So you know, the mother's telling the child, you know, playing, okay, you have to go to sleep. The child says, oh, come on, you know, let me finish the game. Pretty normal behavior, right? So mothers of aggressive boys are more likely to interpret that as very chutzpahdikah behavior, rebelliousness. And what's even more statistically significant and amazing is they attribute malicious intent. It's not that the kid's son wants to play or finish his game. He wants to be in control, he's manipulating me. I had a mother once told me about her 5-month-old infant that he's manipulating me. He doesn't stand a chance. Okay, so that's on the part of the parent. Now, on the part of the child, you get both back to the question if there's something genetic or you know, predispositions, you know, which I don't know if it's answerable. I'm not sure how much of a difference it makes. We still have to do with what we, you know, apidarka, whatever we can do with the child. My guess is the question is why one child, not another child. Right. Okay, why that child, not another one? You know, Daniel Stern, who's, you know, the infant, he's one of the big researchers, the mother of the infant, is an incredible study. Maybe that answers some of these questions. It's fascinating. He once spoke somewhere. He said one of the first mother-child infants. They take movies of mothers impacting the children, and they play frame by frame to compare. This was, I think, somewhere in Europe. This mother had twin boys, and they were following them from the beginning. And with one of the boys, she was having tremendous problems. With another one, was like perfectly fine. So they interviewed the mother in depth about, you know, her marriage, her relation with the husband, and you know, the whole history. And they found out that at the time that these children were born, she was having difficulties in her marriage. And one of the main tainas on her husband was that he's very passive. That was like one of the major issues. So when she was expecting these two twins, she identified one as the passive one and one is the active one. And when he was born, she decided he was passive, that this is her husband. Okay, but still it still doesn't beg the question, so what happened differently? They played the videos of her interacting. You know, everybody knows with children, with little infants, they cue us. You know, if you interact with a child, they get tired of you, they look away from you. And most mothers instinctively, when the child shows a sign that he or she are tired of you, you leave the child alone. So with the child that she identified with herself, that's what she was doing. With the other child, she was constantly overriding his signals. What was really fascinating me about the story, because I had a mindset, after I read this study, Imamish helped me with a guide, because this guide came to me and said he doesn't know what happened. It was after Pesach. He stayed part of the Pesach by his parents and part of the Pesach by his in-laws. And his little infant, by his, I don't remember which one it was. Chudanknish was by one of them, was mamish, totally impossible. Didn't have a minute manucha. So I had this in mind, and it turns out that I think it was by his in-laws. He had the problems in the relationship there. Like he was trying to make things better by getting his kid to perform. So he was overstimulating the kid and not picking up the kid's, you know, reactions and signals that they're tired of. And he was just riding over signals. So here's something that shows what can happen between two kids. studies have shown that, you know, no two children in the same family grow up with the same parents. I'm not sure if I'm the one who should address the question. Probably an educator can answer best. But I would just say one point. Okay, yeah. One thing that I would say is that, again, depends who brought up the issue. And if a child comes and complains that they're being disturbed by another child, helping that child become more assertive and stick up for their rights to have a quiet classroom is one thing. The teacher feeling hopelessly overwhelmed by these 10 rabble rousers and therefore trying to elicit the help of other teachers is probably something else. Rav Moshe has a tshuva about asking children to snitch on other children. He says there's a dover mechur lasik kain, and he fended off every attempt at squeezing out a heter for it. But there's obviously a big difference if a child on his own is daigis about his chavri, sees a chavri doing something wrong, comes to the Rebbe, wants to, you know, maybe the Rebbe can do something, is different than the Rebbe using, because the Rebbe feels helpless in trying to find out who the culprit is, and asking the child to snitch is a whole big difference. I'm saying it's the same difference. If the child themselves are disturbed by other children bothering them and they want to know what to do, and you suggest that they be more assertive about their right to have a quiet classroom, that's one thing. I'm saying, I would suspect a little bit of using, like trying to use them as a tool to help you have a quieter classroom. I'd be very concerned. But again, I'm not sure if I'm the best person to address that question, but that's not my field of expertise. I would rather not stand in front of a class of 25 children. I'll take them one at a time. Yes? Okay. I'm glad you brought that up.
Sometimes I have a student who's getting a B or a C and she's going for AP and the parents sometimes I think it's a parent. Even like it's scored for the student child because of the problem.
Okay. I'm glad you said that. I want to tell you that I've often been very concerned myself, you know, how I come across to the parent, because I speak a lot to the parents about their part in this issue. I must tell you that most of the parents take it very well because they see it helps. Right? When I tell a father, listen, you can't be an absentee father. Your wife shouldn't be teaching your son Mishnayot. You know, you should be involved with your son. You have to spend more. He's a boy. He needs a father. And you should be more involved with him. I would say that 99% of them, and even the ones, you know, who have a harder time following their suggestions and recommendations, a lady recently told me, your older son is obsessive compulsive, a perfectionist, he's getting better, the father is fighting therapy tooth and nail, the mother is more understanding, but the mother is telling me, you know, his brother is beginning to learn from him. I always love this argument, you know, this point, right? He's learning from him. I say, the one I'm treating is oldest. I say, it's interesting, who does oldest learn from? She says, so what is happening? I said, probably the same thing that caused the older one to have this problem is causing the second one. Because, yeah, I thought you were going to say that. I also tell the parents that I know that they love their children, and I haven't met a parent, maybe one or twice, or one or two, you know, very disturbed people, you know, who wouldn't give their lives for their children. So this has nothing to do with you know, that they're, who don't like their kids, or, you know, wouldn't do anything for them. Right? No, I'm not blaming anybody. No, it's not the cause. They have the biggest influence, even if a child, let's say, is hyperactive. It's a difficult thing to treat. You know, that's a tremendous burden on any parent. Right? But they're still the most important people. Because if they tell the child, you know, we know you're trying your best, and, you know, we'll do whatever we do can help you, and they're supportive, obviously they're going to have a different result. If they, you know, there are many kids who are clearly hyperactive who've been told for years that they're lazy. Again, it's not necessarily the parents' fault. They may not have known. There's one yeshiva in New York that I called the principal, you know, with the family and the child's permission. I say, you know, I'm fairly positive this kid should be evaluated because I'm 99% sure this kid is hyperactive. He goes, what's hyperactive? Okay? So this kid's for years has been told that he's lazy. Now, it bothered him that his teachers have told him that, but let me tell you, it bothered him 100 times more than his parents believed it. One father recently told me that, I asked him, why do you think your child has this problem? Whatever it was that I remember, he told me, I'll never forget his words. He said he's a self-indulgent truant. Okay? I mean, where's it? Again, I'm not saying he's not a bad man. He's a nice guy. He's overwhelmed with the problems with his child. But
you have to be honest about, you know, you have to tell the smoker that smoking can cause cancer, you know, even though it's a little painful for the person to hear. Yeah. Well meaning, because, you know, they want them to be good kids, so they criticize them, yes.
I once heard you give a mushroom that criticism. Yeah. Could you share it with everyone?
You'll have to remind me, I don't remember.
The sunburn.
You know, the muscle, if I remember it, is you know, sometimes people say, well, I meant well. You know, I think, was that it? I think, you know, as I say, imagine, it's oh, no, I...
No criticism.
Right. Oh, yeah, and what happens, especially when... When the relationship really gets bad, and things, and again, we're not talking about normal situations, of course, where parents have to guide and sometimes criticize and, you know, hopefully balance, but, you know, but when the situation gets bad, and the parents get real upset at me, what do you mean, I can't tell them anything? It comes up 2 o'clock in the morning, I can't say anything? And I tell them, listen, imagine if somebody has a terrible sunburn, right? You give him a pat on his back. Of course, he jumps 100 miles. Of course, you meant well, you're just trying to be friendly, but it doesn't matter. When a child is in this situation, then it's like having a sunburn. Yes?
As you spoke about before, I think has really over to the criticism of accomplishment and compliment. You said that, if I remember it correctly, you said that if a child, let's say, has trouble socially, but he's very, very excellent student. So it's a bigger thing to compliment him, but he has to go to a friend and vice versa, right? Because that's a big thing to discover on how many other people. The converse of that, I want to explore a little bit. Let's say a child has social problems, or just social problems, but he doesn't sell at Sampson, or whatever the case may be, which is an antisocial thing, just by itself. As a parent, maybe as a teacher as well, you want to find an akuda to give him his. You want to be able to compliment him on something that he does do well. Granted, if he makes a phone call to the friend, that's a compliment. Of course you want to compliment that. But if, according to the way I understood, maybe I missed
something.
The idea of complimenting him on things that he does well will reinforce the things he does well and not cause him, I think, from what I understood, to strive for the things that are coming difficult, which everybody would want, of course, it's difficult. But isn't it also true that if you don't compliment him on what he does well, and the other thing he doesn't do well, you have nothing to compliment him for? And doesn't every human being need to be complimented?
Yeah, what I would say is like this. If you have an open relationship with a child and you both can talk openly about the fact that socialization is difficult for him, right? So you can do both. You say, wonderful, you know so much about stamps. It's a beautiful thing. You're buying books about stamps and do them. But then you tell him, look, you know, he could be honest with you then that part of his enjoyment of stamp collection is avoiding socialization. And then you can tell him at some point, you know, I think it's enough. And maybe you should play a little bit. Again, you know, if it's not being spoken about, that's a problem. A lot of times these things are not either, the parents are not aware it's a problem or they don't speak about it. Yeah, if you have to speak in a non-critical way, and it's very difficult for a parent when you are polishing inside because your kid never speaks to anybody, it's very difficult to do it in a non-critical way. I don't have an easy solution for that because it would be difficult for any parent.
The balance being maybe enough.
Yeah,
well.
100%.
The pressure was that of course.
I'm glad you clarified that. No, of course you should, you know, also compliment on that.
I find that most students are really not very constructive. They're very intelligent. And the other people who are going to be a lot of students and students as well, actually, they make a lot of time. And so they're talking about the position of them. And I think, you know, you need an outcome, you need to come, you need to be nice and good. And she said, I really want to be a very happy that you're here. I really want to be happy. I want myself in my own house. They're sitting in the kitchen box. And I beg you, clearly remember the teacher. Social aspects, you don't want to get into trouble with everybody else, you want to put yourself aside and decide your power on your own. I wrote it really quickly, very friendly. Maybe the child doesn't need that point of the way. How will you judge? Maybe you judge on our level of social. Maybe I need more social than the child does. Is it possible that the child would only as far as
100%. Sure. And sometimes Okay, obviously you have to trust your instincts. If your child never speaks to anybody anytime, it's probably a problem. If they're just not as sociable as everybody else.
Or they're suffering.
You're right. Another thing you can do is see, that's a very good point, and I'll just see what else is going on. If the kid's getting decent grades, they seem to be happy. And they have, usually the extremes are usually a problem. What happens, we are sometimes hypersensitive, sometimes when the parents themselves may have had a problem socializing, for example, they're the ones who tend to overreact, you know, to force a child to socialize all the time because they're afraid of the child will be like them. Yeah. But obviously it's a, yeah.
You mentioned about the split.
Yeah.
How do you deal with
the split? That's difficult, but yeah, but what I do is, first of all, I make the split clear to the person, because I had one, this fellow, that he was really an extreme case of it, and he came once for therapy for 2 months, and he dropped out, he came back after a year, he had a very hard time dealing with it. But one thing that used to happen, he used to tell me, he did X, Y, and Z, things he shouldn't have been doing, then came to shul, he went to the mikveh, and then he said that he had a gehiv in the Shabbos, you know? I say, that's the problem. You don't need a gehiv in a Shabbos. You need like a normal Shabbos. The Bahim was either one extreme or the other. His antidote to anything bad he did was something gehiv. You know? He'll sit down and learn Mamish, you know, Ramchals and the Chleislos and, you know. He kept on trying to wipe away the bad and pretend like it isn't there and be like a different person. And I would say you have to integrate. And I always emphasize the integration. That, you know, you're one person, you're not two different people. Because first of all, we as Mechansim or as parents, we sometimes tell to the kid, that was your Yetzirah that did it, as if he came some, you know, a Martian from outer space. You know, it has nothing to do with you. What do you mean? It's you. Yetzirah is part of you, part of yourself. And in a sense, so he always saw it as like a separate thing, and he wiped away that thing. He doesn't want to hear about it anymore. He didn't want to talk about it. Okay, no, this is part of you, and why does this happen to you? He never had any clue about his need to build up. He didn't even know he had a low self-esteem. And then they know about all the pain he suffered his whole life and how this is. Once he understood it, try to get him to see the Geheibenkeit in everyday things. That was the idea. The fact that he was able to. There was a fellow that told me, a Rav. He's a Rav somewhere, right? And he has all kinds of problems. So he tells me he has a simen that he's getting better. What's his simen that he's getting better? Because he said over to his Balabatim something from a Sefer that's not so commonly found. So he asked, one of his Balbatim asked him, where did you see that? And he said, for the first time in his life, he was able to say an art scroll. He said, he thought for a minute, should he lie? And then he said, no, he'll say the truth. He can handle it. Understand? So that's the cure. The cure is, you should fail. If you saw an art scroll, you can be honest about it. He said, he told me, he used to always have to read the art scroll. You know, that, he had to do that. He certainly would never admit that he even looked at it. Now he was able to handle it. Yeah, so you're with me?
Yeah.
I mean, it's both. I mean, he began to understand himself better and work out the pain, which was the underlying structure of the whole thing. It's both. I was just saying conceptually what I was trying to do was get him to be able to...
I get trapped in the idea.
I fall into that trap all the time. But they usually correct me.
Yeah.
Yes. Right.
How much is different?
You know, kind of.
What about society? How does society
affect? Society, what's effective? So we talked about home, we talked about school. What about society? Last week I spoke to Rabbi Tzvi Salman, and he told me, in his opinion, he doesn't think anything is happening now dramatically different than it happened. They're just taking different forms. Years ago they had problems with Haskola, half of the Klal Yisrael got lost over there with Haskola, it was basically the same problem. Today it takes different form. I'm not too sure if anything today is happening is so dramatically different. Of course society, it's needless to say what's going on in society is like a double question, and the need to protect yourself from society is obvious too. But when people say that kids go off to death because of society, I, with all due respect, totally disagree. I don't think there's one kid in the world who went off to death because of something in the media. It is true that the form of going off, the right is, I don't think statistically there's any more kids, more or less, going off to death in those places where people are much more protected from the media, and those places are not. I get equal, yeah, they might be less wrong in what we, to feed certain standards. I'm not saying they're not affected by it, I'm not saying that at all. Obviously they're affected by it, but they don't go off to derech, whatever their derech is. And I'm saying the rebelliousness aspect of it is, I think, equal among all areas of the spectrum. Obviously people are more affected than me to live a certain type of lifestyle, and you can say that they have less kedusha, and you can say whatever you want, fine, I have no disagreement with that. But it has nothing to do with going off to derech. That's what I'm saying. One has to be careful. You can give great arguments of being protected from the media, hundreds of them, but that's not one of them.
What do you think of going off to derech?
It's like a kid who rebels against his family ways of the way of life. But that comes from a break in the Messiah, a break in the chain, and that depends on the relationship. If a kid has a decent relationship with his parents, he's part of the Messiah. And then...
Whatever level they are.
Whatever they are, yeah. So, I'm not saying he's going to... Yeah, I'm sorry, yeah. Well, because I think the problem there is whether you focus on the goal or the process. I think my wife mentioned that Rabbi Belsky spoke about the process, something I always talk about. If you focus in Ruchnis, it should be such an easy thing. You know, in other things, it's difficult. You know, Chafetz Chaim's famous word on the mail, the Hema mail, and the Kamis Sky. We get signed the mail list. What do you mean you're ready? You're ready right now. No, because the idea is not to reach it. The idea is to be on the process to it. No, they're not trying to. The goal is to strive. The goal is to strive. The goal is to strive. Is not to reach a particular goal, because who knows which goal you're going to reach. That is the goal, is to strive to reach goals. Okay, Zognik, but I'm saying, but I think this is the kuda, the process, that's usually the difference between a perfectionist and not a perfectionist. A perfectionist only looks at the eventual goal. The goal is always somewhere over there, and you never reach it.
Striving for Ruchnius.
Striving for Ruchnius, yeah, that's in the kuda. So. Oh yeah. Oh, so that's the problem. Is especially in our generation that there's high expectations. The problem is you need to point out right where the source of the drive is. Yeah. But the way it is important to always point out the kids, especially in the area they have difficulty with the progress they're making. You know, there was a fellow I was treating who was physically abusive to his wife. So I remember after a while. At one point he tells me, I'm so discouraged, I'm mamish not getting anywhere. You know, yesterday I yelled at my wife. There is a difference between being physically abusive and yelling. He's also not good, but you know, that is progress. And people, you have a guy, you know, can say, I'm so depressed. You know, yesterday I couldn't learn for the whole Seder. You know, the fact that there's a process that you're doing something, it is important to constantly point out, you know, the fact that, look what you've accomplished. You remember what it used to be like? You know, if a guy loses his temper very easily, now that it happens much more. I always ask him, tell me, does it happen whenever they come discouraged and not getting better? Whatever the problem is, I say, does it happen with the same frequency and the same intensity? Baruch Hashem, I hardly ever answer yes. Because you know, it happens less frequently, it's not so intense, I get over it quicker, isn't that progress? And that a lot of them are missing because they look in absolute terms and they're constantly looking at the goal. They're supposed to be reaching a certain goal and they're not there, so they're frustrated. Alright? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.